Today on Vox Talks Economics, COP27 and the Great Carbon Arbitrage. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember to subscribe, follow us on Instagram and give us a good review as well. We're used to thinking big on Vox Talks, but I don't think we've ever had an $85 trillion idea on the table. Well, it's the first time for everything, and a COP conference is the right time to consider this idea. According to a new discussion paper, $85 trillion is the net gain of phasing out coal and replacing it with renewables. Alisa Klein-Nyenhaus of INET and Patrick Bolton of Imperial College are two of the authors, and during COP27 I've been talking to them about how they arrived at this extraordinary number and the prospects for what they are calling the Great Carbon Arbitrage. Patrick, this work's all about phasing out coal. Why are we focusing just on coal here?
We're focusing on coal because among the fossil fuels, coal is the worst in terms of carbon emissions per unit of energy produced, and therefore is the one source of energy you want to stop using sooner than fossil fuel energy. And along with that, there have been some policy efforts for a while focusing on coal, specifically getting a global agreement to phase out coal. There was a big effort in Glasgow to get some kind of agreement on that. And then you may not remember, but the deal didn't come through to the disappointment of the UK government that put a huge effort towards that.
I do actually remember all the discussions on that. I was very hopeful for a while that we would get something, but that hasn't turned into anything.
It hasn't turned into anything because several countries, among which China and India, who rely a lot on coal,
yes,
essentially didn't want to agree to anything that would constrain them very much.
Now, we talk to many economists about what should be done to mitigate climate change on Vox Talks Economics, and they often will talk about taxing carbon. And one of the points of taxing carbon is it reduces coal consumption. But your benefit that you've come up with is nothing like the benefits that they talk about, $85 trillion. Now, is this because your initial assumptions are different to theirs, or is it because your methodology, the way you do your accounting, is different?
It's neither a question of accounting so much nor methodology. It's because we're asking a question that's never been asked before. What economists have been focusing on almost exclusively, is the question, how much should we price a marginal increase in carbon, an additional ton of CO2 relative to what we were already emitting? That's what people refer to as the marginal social cost of carbon. And economists are focused on that question. We're asking a very different question. We're saying, if we were to phase out all of coal and we were to gain all these avoided emissions from coal, given that we replace coal with a renewable energy, so not emitting any carbon, what do we gain? Then the numbers become staggering. They are staggering because the gain in terms of avoided emissions in aggregate is of the order of 1,400 plus gigatons of CO2. Mm-hmm. It's enormous. Nobody has ever asked, well, if we were to do this, what's the total benefit? And that's what we do. And we come up with a absolutely staggering number. We had absolutely no idea beforehand what we would get, what the numbers would be. And yeah, we were really taken aback.
Some economists would say, of course, coal produces carbon and that's an externality. So logically, you're going to have a gain if you reduce that externality. But what is really surprising for us is that we're not just saying, okay, there's a benefit from reducing coal emissions because you have fewer climate damages. We're saying there is a net benefit of $85 trillion under a very conservative estimate. When you don't only take into consideration, you know, the avoided climate damages from putting fewer emissions into the air, but when you account for the investment cost in renewables, as well as the compensation you have to do for the opportunity cost of coal, net of those two costs, it is a huge benefit. We indeed had no idea of whether there actually would be a benefit. And in our analysis, we've taken very conservative assumptions on what the, you know, the average social cost of carbon is, which is an estimate of the average damages from putting an extra ton of CO2 into the atmosphere, as well as very conservative assumptions on everything else. Mm-hmm. So we really view this estimate as somewhat of a lower bound, and it could be much higher than this number.
But for this to be more than a thought experiment, for these benefits to actually be realized, then the people who mine the coal would have to agree to keep the coal in the ground. Why would they do this?
You pay them to agree to keep the coal in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It's in their interest at that point to do so, because they get paid what they would get otherwise by extracting coal. You know, coal is not a fun job, being a miner. So if you get paid not to do it, at some point you think, yeah, I'm better off not doing it. And the point is, the numbers that we get in terms of the net benefit overall to the world, they are net of the compensation.
There are examples where coal owners were successfully compensated for shutting down coal mines early. So prior to the great energy shock of the Ukraine, Germany had an auction system in place where coal power plants could place bids in return for committing to shut down their gigawatts of operations early. And that was very successful, because indeed these coal power plants got paid actually somewhat more than their opportunity cost of coal, or their missed revenues from shutting it down early. So it was in their interest. And a question that we often then got asked is, okay, but you know, you're looking at this narrow definition of the opportunity cost of coal. There are entire coal communities. They may also be made worse off by, you know, having to shut down this industry. And so what we've done recently is also estimate what the cost would be for workers that lose their job in the coal mining industry, as well as what the retraining cost might be to employ them in other industries, in particular the renewable industry. Mm-hmm. And we find that that indeed, you know, increases the cost from 50 billion globally in present value terms to around 331 billion. But it's very small compared to the trillion number that we have in net benefit. So it doesn't really affect our estimate of the net gain.
Is that something that didn't happen when the coal industry shut down in the UK during the 1990s? It is interesting to find out that the numbers for that are maybe not as big as many people think. But another number that has to be offset against the potential gains is the cost of finding alternative sources of energy. Where is that going to come from, in your estimation?
This is where a lot of the heavy lifting has gone, coming up with the very precise estimates of how much additional renewable energy would need to replace the energy produced by coal. And when I say renewable energy, it's a mix of wind and solar, plus some additional capacity to address the intermittency problem of renewables. If you take all of those costs, how much investment costs to set up your renewable facilities?
So what we propose is to basically phase out coal and phase in renewables concurrently, such that you always make sure that for any energy of, you know, unit of energy of coal that you reduce, you have an extra unit of energy produced by renewables. And this is, of course, really important to ensure that you have sufficient energy supply, because you want to make sure that the whole world can, you know, keep consuming what they need to consume. It's also important, if you don't strike a global deal to phase out coal, to minimize carbon leakage.
So if you add these together on the cost side, compensation and finding other sources of energy, what do you get?
In present value terms, we estimate that the total cost to transition away from coal towards renewables is 29 trillion. When you account both for the investment cost to build replacement renewables, as well as for the opportunity cost of coal. And we don't just calculate this at the level of the globe. We actually break this down so that we know for every country that is relying on coal, how much should be invested, both in present value terms, but also over time. So we actually provide the first quantitative estimates of sort of the climate financing needs to transition away from coal.
Put against that is the benefit calculation, which relies, as you said, on the social cost of carbon. And you've mentioned a couple of times that you've been conservative in your estimation of this. Where are you getting the numbers from?
We are relying on a survey of climate experts, both the economists and climate scientists. This is a very extensive survey that was done by Bob Pindyke at MIT 3 years ago. He approached something like 6,000 plus experts. He got a response from about 1,000 experts, and he had accurate estimates by, you know, several hundreds of experts. And as I said, they're divided into climate economists on the one hand and other experts, including climate scientists. And the way he surveys them is what's interesting. He asks them what they think should be the total reduction in emissions relative to business as usual to avoid a major disaster in terms of the climate outcome. And major disaster is defined as a loss in global GDP of more than 20% by a certain date. These experts have come up with very consistent numbers of what they think the ballpark number is in terms of emission reductions. And those are in line with our calculation of the emissions that would be avoided if you phase out coal. So we have 1,400 gigatons of CO2, and these experts come to something like 1,100 gigatons of CO2. That's the order of difference. Pindyke asks them, okay, so we're avoiding 20% GDP loss with high probability. How much in your estimate is that worth in total? And then he says, well, I can divide that benefit by the size of avoided emissions, and I get an estimate from these experts of the average social cost of carbon. And the lower bound estimate from that survey is $80 per ton of CO2, which is what we are using. And it's the absolute lower bound is when you take out outliers, when you, you know, you say, let's forget about the climate scientists, let's just focus on the economists who have lower numbers anyway. Let's throw away all the economists who are not very precise. And you get a number of 80, whereas, you know, the average is more like 150 or 160 when you look at all the survey responses.
There are a couple of lower estimates, though, as well. What's the interval on this? If we get a much lower social cost of carbon, how much of the benefit goes away? And if we get some of those higher estimates, how big does it get?
How much lower than 80? There we have to rely on studies that have looked at the marginal social cost of carbon, which is not exactly the same thing as the average. But even relying on those studies, you'd have to go to something like a social cost of carbon of $20-$25 per ton of CO2 to eliminate the net benefits, to break even. But everybody now agrees that $20 is way too low. And you see that also now reflected in how carbon emissions are priced in emission trading schemes in Europe and elsewhere. In Europe today, a ton of CO2 on the EU emission trading system has at the beginning of this year been trading at over 90 euro per ton.
The Biden administration, I think, is proposing to set up a carbon credit system where coal power plants can sell their emission rights. And under that plan, they could sell that for at least $30 per ton of CO2. So that means that actually they can reap a net gain by selling that right to emit and then building renewables in its place. And that's the carbon arbitrage that we refer to.
To get from where we are now to where you propose that we could be, someone has to invest and this all has to be paid for. How's that going to happen and who's going to make it happen?
There are multiple levels in response to this question. The first is to get everyone to focus on the large size of benefits, which has never been done before. And hopefully it gets people's attention. They say, well, maybe we should try harder than we did in Glasgow. Find an agreement because the benefit is much larger than we anticipated. The second step is that you want any kind of financing that's put on the table. You want to think of that financing in terms of paying for the renewable energy that replaces coal. Tie the financing of renewables to conditionality to phase out coal. And then the third point we make is that much of that financing will come from the private sector. it's of the order of 90% of the money that's needed. It's private sector money, 10% is public sector money in the form of blended finance. And then the numbers become, in terms of public money commitments, become very reasonable. And then the final point we make is that when you look at country by country, if every country was paying itself for its own investment needed in renewables to replace coal, the vast majority of countries would find it in their self-interest to agree to join a global phase out of coal, even on that basis, without asking for money from others.
A lot of these climate change mitigation policies soon boil down to who are the winners and losers going to be, and then the argument starts. You're saying that there's really only winners in this? Are there any prominent losers?
By setting up the arrangement in the way we propose, you can really make it in all the interest of all the key stakeholders to partake, where mm-hmm. the key stakeholders are the coal companies and their communities, the investors and the governments and sort of the people that they represent. So the coal companies get, you know, compensated and the coal communities at least their opportunity costs. So they should be willing to partake. The investors basically get a more attractive risk return profile because the multilateral development banks funded by governments would take the first loss tranche for investments in renewables. So there's still a revenue stream that investors get, but at a much lower risk. So they should be willing to help finance the transition. We can show that if we take into consideration how climate impacts are distributed unevenly across the world, that for most countries, the payments that they would have to do to finance the transition away from coal are much smaller than the benefits that they gain, given again how climate change impacts are distributed across the world from avoided climate damages and from avoided climate adaptation costs. Ideally, you strive for a global deal to phase out coal because then you reap the biggest net benefits in terms of avoided emissions, avoided climate damages. But even if that's not possible, there's still big tangible benefits to be reaped. And so what we show in the paper is that imagine that only one region were to phase out coal. I don't know, it could be Africa as an example. If you make the financing for renewables conditional on the commitment to phase out coal, then you make sure that when you reduce coal in, let's say, Africa, you increase renewables at the same time such that you don't get a lot of carbon leakage because the energy demand can now just be met with renewables. So you get this big net gain, even if the rest of the world does not act. And we can show that there are big benefits to other regions, let's say Europe, if Africa were to phase out coal. So we can show that climate finance for developing countries is not just equitable. It's not just a moral imperative. It is, in fact, self-interest because the West would be better off. And, you know, if you've read the FT over the last couple of weeks, you know, there's now a deal being struck with South Africa where Western lenders such as the UK and Germany basically provide financing to help South Africa phase out coal and replace it with renewables. Indeed, even if only South Africa phases out coal, there are some substantial net benefits which actually make it in the interest, not just in the moral incentives of the West to help do this. So our point is that ideally you seek for this global deal. There are these huge net benefits that can be reaped, and we want to make sure that everyone is aware, as Patrick says. But even if you don't get the main prize, it's still worthwhile to work in bits.
The best estimates we have by the most knowledgeable experts about the cost of business as usual, and here I'm referring to a study by Swiss Re. Mm-hmm. Swiss Re estimates that under a business as usual scenario, we are headed to a world where we're going to lose roughly 20% of GDP by 2050. Mm-hmm. We're helping growth in the long run. It's not holding back growth. And I think that's the selling point. That's the message that has to be conveyed.
Well, what we've been talking about today is cozy and bargaining. And to strike a bargain, then the best thing to do is to get every interested party together. They are literally, as we record this, in the same room. COP27 has just kicked off. So my idea, guys, is when COP27's closing and those conversations have been had, we get back together, we discuss how much of this benefit you think might be realized.
There's been a sense of great expectations from this particular COP, known as the Implementation COP,
John Kerry unveiled a carbon offset plan that would allow corporations to fund renewable energy projects in developing countries.
We'll help other countries to be able to do what they need to do.
We're proving that good climate policy is good economic policy.
Okay, guys, so we're now nearly at the end of COP27. And so I wanted to catch up with you again. I'm delighted to have both of you back to see whether you think the probability of your great carbon arbitrage to phase out coal, whether that probability has increased in the last 2 weeks or not. Welcome back, Patrick. First thing I wanted to ask you about is the news at COP27. John Kerry's proposal, he proposed an energy transition accelerator, phasing out coal. It's financed by selling carbon credits at $30 a ton. Sounds like a good deal. How close is that to the spirit of what you're proposing here?
It's close to what we're proposing. It's a very interesting initiative. It's to be seen as a very rough blueprint at this point. But the idea is a sound idea. And just to summarize what the idea is you are financing the phase out of coal at the level of the coal companies. You're paying them to phase themselves out. How do you pay them? By paying for the avoided emissions that go with the decarbonization, with the phase out. And what's interesting in the proposal is that you can use carbon offset markets to make that happen, to pay the coal companies. Now, there have been a lot of criticisms already of the proposal. They have to do with the fact that it's just a blueprint, very rough one, many questions about how the proposal concretely fits in with the existing landscape of carbon credit markets and all the weaknesses around this landscape and all the institutional challenges. But the proposal itself is a good one. And the good part of the proposal is that you pay the coal companies for avoided emissions. The not so good part is when you say $30 per ton avoided, who's going to pay that and why? If you're really serious, what you want is you want someone to pay, let's say a corporation in the US or in Europe. Why would they pay? Well, because they are required to reduce their emission on a net basis. And it's cheaper for them to do that by buying offsets than doing it directly. And the more you require companies to decarbonize on a net basis in Europe, in the US, elsewhere, the more the demand is for carbon offsets, the higher the price and the easier it is to find buyers for the avoided emissions sold by coal companies that are reducing their emissions.
We estimate that a net gain can be reaped from replacing coal with renewables if the global average social cost of carbon is at least $20 per ton of CO2. So even at a low price of, you know, being able to sell carbon credits at 30 ton, we estimate that, you know, you can already make a gain from building renewables instead of coal. And of course, the higher the price of those carbon credits rises, the more beneficial becomes, the greater the arbitrage.
I think it's fair to say that if there isn't disagreement about something that you announce at a COP conference, then really you're not announcing enough, isn't it? And one other area where there has been disagreement is that some countries are not keen to just exclusively look at phasing out coal. They want to tie other fossil fuels to it. That was something that India was talking about. Does this get in the way of any progress at all?
You'd like to include oil and gas, but if by adding oil and gas, you make it more complicated and nothing is done, that's bad.
Now, we talked when we first spoke last week about how a lot of money seems to be left on the table in climate negotiations. And so my final question to you is, from what you've seen at COP27, is that still the case?
The short answer is yes.
What about a slightly longer answer?
COP26... it was set up for a major announcement. And the major announcement of COP26 was going to be global agreement on phasing out coal.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't happen. Fast forward 1 year later, COP27. What are they going to say was the big accomplishment? That's a big question mark. There have been some progress in different areas, but I think people will come back to COP27 and they will say, oh, not much happened. You've got to ask yourself at some point,
how effective is this whole process? We're now into COP27. Carbon emissions keep rising. Coming back to your question, what about adding oil and gas? One of the problems with COP is it's too much at the same time being discussed by too many players. And that's maybe the weakness of COP, is that you need more focused, more structured discussions on very concrete proposals, such as the one we discussed in our paper. So let's phase out coal, replace it with renewable, let's cost it, let's find ways of financing it. Let's see how far we can go just on that. Maybe not enough going on in that spirit around COP.
We identified a huge net gain, indeed, that can be reaped by globally phasing out coal. Not all is lost if that's not possible right now. Even if you only manage block by block to strike country deals to phase out coal, you can reap substantial net benefits. Of course, those would be much smaller than in a global deal, so we should all strive for a global deal. But we can work towards a global deal by going step by step and phasing out coal in individual countries. And so what we've seen at COP is that international lenders and wealthier countries are helping some poorer countries transition away from coal. So in particular, the announcement was made that Japan and the US with the G7 countries are putting in public funding to help Indonesia transition away from coal. And in total, $20 billion will be offered, half of which will actually come from capital markets, from various institutions. So it's a blended finance deal as we propose. And in the paper, we show that if you make the financing for renewables to help Indonesia transition away from coal conditional on the commitment to phase out coal, such that it phases out coal in the process, you will reap tangible reductions in emissions that reduce climate damages in other parts of the world. So it's actually also in the economic interest of these international lenders to offer this financing, because it will help them be better off. Providing this financing for renewables to move away from coal is not just equitable, right? It's not just equitable to help Indonesia move away, but it could be self-interest because your climate damages will be less. So this is a, you know, not at the scale that we hoped, but it's an example of progress. And we hope that such deals can be replicated across all major coal producing countries.
Well, let's hope that that progress will continue. I suppose we ought to say fingers crossed for COP28, but I think I've said something very similar about that several times over the last few years. Thanks very much for coming back and talking to me again today. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
The discussion paper is called The Great Carbon Arbitrage, and the authors are Tobias Adrian, Patrick Bolton, and Elisa Klein-Nyenhaus. It is discussion paper 17554 at CPR, and there is also a VoxEU column on the same topic.